welcome to the July edition of the Astropod. As usual, I'm Quinton Goddard.
And not as usual, I'm Michelle Collins.
So Michelle, normally we've got you locked away in the Astronomy Joke of the Month section. What prompted us to let you out?
Well, Anna's away at a conference in France this month, Quincy, so she's unable to sit here and banter with you.
Away, or have you tied her up?
Maybe some of both.
I see. So what's going on in the world of astronomy? I hear there's some kind of news about the Ulysses spacecraft?
Yeah, well, it's sad news for the Ulysses spacecraft, I'm afraid, Quinton. After 18 years of service, ESA and NASA are going to pull the plug on the mission.
That is a great shame, because the Ulysses spacecraft shares its name with my favourite all-time children's cartoon show, Ulysses 31.
That's true, but the Ulysses spacecraft was actually a little bit more useful in terms of science than the TV show, Quincy.
But perhaps not more useful in terms of animation.
Perhaps not. But it brought us many great discoveries. It was the first object to look at space around the poles of the sun, and it also brought us information as recently as last month, where it told us that the flow of charged particles that come out from the sun in the form of solar wind is actually the lowest it's been in 50 years.
That is an interesting result, Michelle. Well, it's a great shame to see that spacecraft go. But on the lighter side of news, Herschel, the new spacecraft that's replacing Spitzer, has just taken its first images.
Really?
Yes, and they look fantastically good. And the good thing is, it's actually going to get better, because the spacecraft, having just been launched, it's still quite warm and it needs to cool down to get its best pictures. So hopefully it's only going to get better from here on in.
So how long until it gets cool enough to show us some really amazing pictures?
Well, I don't think we're going to see some proper excellent science results for another couple of months, but they're still working on it, going through the calibrations, making sure it's all perfect for the scientists.
Wonderful. I also hear that there's a big anniversary coming up for space at the moment.
Well, that's right. I mean, I don't think either you or myself remember, but 40 years ago on the 21st of July, it was actually the moon landings, which is obviously a massive day in, well, for the whole of mankind.
And are there any plans to return to the moon in the near future, Quinton?
Well, NASA are planning to send some astronauts back to the moon. But interestingly, many high-level scientists, like our own Astronomer Royal, Professor Martin Rees, actually suggest that it's a big waste of money sending humans to other planets like Mars and the moon. They suggest that sending robotic explorers could be a lot more valuable, cheaper, and get better scientific results.
That's good. Maybe I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, Michelle, it certainly appears as if you have forgotten what you were going to say, which means it's back to the Joke of the Month section for you next month.
Ah, damn.
Yes, you'll have to untie Anna and get her back here. So, what's coming up later on in the show?
Well, we have the news with Laura, Sky at Night with Alex, our history section, and of course, the incredible Joke of the Month, for which there cannot be enough praise.
Well, we all enjoy the joke, Michelle, but some would say the interview is the highlight of the Astropod. And this month, I'm very pleased to be speaking to Nick Ross about supernova, dark energy, and the BOSS survey, which is actually trying to look for dark energy.
And before all of that, we have the news with Laura Churcher.
Hi, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Possible solar system collision. A recent Nature paper by Jacques Lascar from the University of Paris has suggested that in 3 billion years from now, the terrestrial planets of the solar system could collide with each other. The team ran over 2,500 computer simulations of the evolution of the orbital motions of the planets over the next 5 billion years. These are the most sophisticated dynamical models to date, including effects from the Moon and general relativity. In 1% of the models, Mercury's orbit increased in ellipticity, eventually becoming so eccentric that it collided with Venus or the Sun. In one such simulation, the eccentricity of Mercury after 3.3 billion years was large enough to destabilize all of the terrestrial planets, resulting in possible collisions between Venus or Mars and the Earth. Although such a fate is undeniably interesting, it is also very unlikely, as it was only one of 2,500 possible outcomes. And even with such advanced models, the motion of the planets is inherently chaotic and thus almost as hard to predict as the weather. Does Enceladus have a subsurface ocean? Saturn's moon Enceladus emits plumes of water vapor and ice particles from stripe-like fractures near the moon's south pole, suggesting the possibility of a subsurface ocean. Particles from these geysers are thought to form the majority of Saturn's E-ring. Cassini studied the particles in the E-ring and found that they were made of ice that contains 1% sodium chloride, so it was suggested that they formed from a salty ocean below Enceladus's icy crust. A recent paper led by Nicholas Schneider used the Keck telescope in Hawaii and a high-resolution spectrograph to look for the atomic signature of sodium in the plumes around Enceladus. When the amount of sodium found in the plumes was compared to the amount expected from models of the ocean, there was around 30 times too little sodium for even the least salty ocean model. So where are the vapour plumes coming from? Well, no one is really sure yet. The sodium content in the grains and the lack of sodium in the plumes can be reconciled if there is a very deep mass of water pressed up against the moon's rocky core, which is dissolving the salts. Water from this subsurface sea is then working its way up to shallower reservoirs through a network of faults in Enceladus's icy mantle. There might be misty caverns just below the fractures where some of the water vaporizes, free of sodium, and some of it, still salt-rich, becomes frozen into the small grains detected by Cassini. However, more data is needed to confirm this hypothesis. Are Lyman alpha blobs a key stage of galaxy formation? Galaxies are generally thought to form through the coalescence of small chunks of dark matter into bigger chunks until eventually stars form in these halos and come together to make modern-sized galaxies. But why did galaxies come out the size they did, rather than staying small or growing indefinitely huge? Around 10 years ago, gassy objects were discovered in the early universe called Lyman alpha blobs. They're named for their emission of ultraviolet light at the Lyman alpha wavelength given off by hot hydrogen atoms. The energy to make the blobs light up must come from somewhere. Apparently, when we see a Lyman alpha blob, we are seeing the blaze from central black holes in the galaxy heating the remaining gas and driving it off into intergalactic space, preventing it from coalescing into new stars. In other words, we're seeing galaxies at the point when they shut off their own growth. This transition stage should be brief in cosmic terms, which is why it's been hard to catch in progress. But the observations from the Chandra X-ray Observatory indicate that nearly all galaxies should go through it. That's all for this month's Astro News.
Thanks for that, Laura. In this month's interview, we'll be talking with Nick Ross about measuring the cosmological constant using supernova data. So this month's history feature is all about the discovery of the cosmological constant. In 1917, Albert Einstein was applying his new theory of general relativity, which shows how the presence of mass affects the shape of space, to the structure of space and time. Back in the early 20th century, Einstein and other scientists from that era didn't know that space was expanding and hence preferred a static universe model, where space is neither expanding nor contracting, but rather is dynamically stable. However, when he applied his equations to such a universe, he found that they didn't quite work because gravity acts to collapse everything together. To counteract this problem, he threw in a hypothetical repulsive force that would balance out his equations, and he called this extra factor the cosmological constant. Then, in the 1920s, Edwin Hubble used a population of variable stars, known as Cepheid variables, to measure distances to other galaxies. The luminosity of these stars changes with time, and the period of this variation has a well-known correlation with their brightness, and as such, they are excellent distance indicators. Hubble concluded from his studies that the universe was not static as it had previously been thought, but was in fact expanding. The idea of the expanding universe revolutionized astronomy and led to the Big Bang theory that the universe began as a tiny point that suddenly and swiftly expanded to create everything we know today. Upon hearing about this result, Einstein discarded his cosmological constant as an unnecessary fudge factor and later came to refer to it as the biggest blunder of his life. However, the cosmological constant remained the subject of theoretical interest to many. Then, in the 1990s, astronomers were observing supernova in an effort to measure how much the expansion of the universe as a result of the Big Bang has slowed over the last few billion years. Surprisingly, the results of these observations indicated that the expansion of the universe is actually accelerating. Such a finding raises the possibility that the universe contains a bizarre form of matter or energy that is, in effect, gravitationally repulsive. The cosmological constant is an example of this type of energy, which is referred to as dark energy, and it is the goal of many astronomical missions to accurately measure this cosmological constant and find out what it means for the evolution of our universe. And now to tell us more about this, here's Quinton and Nick.
Hello and welcome to this month's interview on the AstroPod. This month I'm pleased to welcome Nick Ross to the show. Welcome, Nick.
Hello, good afternoon, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So Nick, you were first of all an undergraduate and PhD student at Durham University before moving off to Penn State, where you're just about to finish your first postdoc placement. How's that all going?
It's going really well, thanks. It's been really groovy.
So you're here to talk to us about dark energy and what's called the BOSS survey. So I guess we'll start off really, you know, and a very good question for amateur astronomers out there. What exactly is dark energy?
Well, this is arguably one of the biggest questions in in not only astronomy and astrophysics, but potentially in the whole of science at the moment. And the first answer is we really just have no idea. So we really just have no idea. And this is actually very exciting, because we're at that point where we've got a lot of evidence that this dark energy, whatever it is, exists. But we're really only at the very initial stages of trying to figure out what exactly it is. So the general idea is that there's been a lot of evidence in the last 10, 12 years from supernovae, from the cosmic microwave background, the heat left over from the Big Bang, that not only do we live in a universe which is expanding, the expansion first seen by Edwin Hubble and others in the 1920s, but that the expansion of the universe is accelerating, and therefore there must be something that is causing the universe to have this accelerated expansion, and we call that was basically ignorant. We call it dark energy, even though we have very little idea if it what it is.
So it's really a complete unknown quantity, but it's just a thing that's responsible for making the universe accelerate in its expansion.
That is exactly it, and this is currently the major way it manifests itself, and we can observe its effects, even though we don't observe this dark energy itself directly at all.
It's really a mysterious quantity, this dark energy. So how do we as astronomers go about trying to detect it and trying to confirm its existence?
Well, the good news is actually there's several different ways astronomers can begin to get evidence for the dark energy. And again, there's nice cross-checks that we can do, and they're all pointing towards its existence. So the first discovery was essentially by different sets of astronomers looking at these huge supernova explosions. And the central point was that the supernova seemed to be slightly dimmer and therefore potentially slightly further away than you might have expected. And this was the evidence that because they were further away or appeared further away, that that the universe actually had not only expanded, but the expansion was accelerating. So supernovae were one of your first evidence, but parts of evidence, and supernovae are what we call standard candles. And the idea of having something standard in astronomy is very, very useful and very helpful. And then more recently, there's been measurements of the cosmic microwave background, the CMB, the heat left over from the Big Bang. And this, again, has basically been a very nice measurement that, again, tells us how much energy in total there is in the universe. And this suggests that we're missing a large proportion of it. And then the final bit of the puzzle, arguably, has been measurement of what we call, understating the problem, what we call the large-scale structure of the universe. And this term, kind of large being not light years or hundreds of light years, but mega light years, millions of light years. And we now have the positions of over a million galaxies and other objects that we can begin to measure the large-scale structure of the universe. And this again gives us, this is another bit of evidence that suggests that the tallying with the CMB that tells us that we don't have, we can't account for all the matter and energy in the universe, and therefore we have to bring in this thing called dark energy to make it all add up.
Now, you talk there about the large-scale structure of the universe by measuring the positions of galaxies, and that's something that the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has really pioneered in the last decade or so. Now, you're working on a new survey called the BOSS Survey. Do you want to explain to us a little bit about how that's going to work?
Sure. So the BOSS Survey is a new galaxy survey which is taking the original Sloan telescope. So this was a telescope high in the mountains of New Mexico in America. And essentially the great thing is that you don't look at just one galaxy at a time with the telescope. You actually now use fiber optics and can look at, well, the new BOSS telescope will hopefully look at 1,000 galaxies at a time. And therefore you essentially construct these huge databases, which would get processed and become very large maps. And ultimately the idea is to have 1.5 million galaxies. And also, there's also going to be a component of even more distant quasars, about 100,000, 150,000 quasars, and figuring out the positions of these galaxies and the positions of these quasars will again be able to give us a road into hopefully determining the properties of dark energy.
So just how many objects is the BOSS survey hoping to measure in the end?
It's hoping to measure just shy of 2 million objects. So it will collect the spectra, it will collect the detailed information of about 1.5 million galaxies, and as I say, almost 200,000 of these more distant and therefore fainter and actually harder to observe quasars. So it's just under 2 million in total, over a period of about 5 years, starting later on in 2009.
So it's certainly a long project you're undertaking.
It's one of these long, you're in it for the long haul once you sign up to one of these things, yes.
Now, you mentioned earlier about standard candles being used to sort of measure the expansion and sort of stretch of the universe. How are you going to be able to do that by measuring the positions of, you know, matter, measuring the positions of galaxies in the universe?
So the big road in, or the big clue that something like the BOSS survey will use, is actually not standard candles, but what we call the standard rulers. And indeed, it's sometimes been framed or termed the cosmic yardstick. And just like anything, if you're measuring anything, you need a ruler. And if you're wanting to measure the expansion of the universe, again, it's much the same idea. If you want to measure it, you essentially need a ruler. And fortunately, though, very fortunately, the universe, nature provides us with a very natural ruler, a very, very big ruler. Indeed, it's about 150 megaparsecs in size. And the very clever thing is that we already have a very precise measurement of the cosmic yardstick, the standard ruler, from the CMB. The physics of the CMB we actually understand really well at very high redshift and very early on in the universe, and that sets the length of the ruler. And therefore, once we get enough measurements of our 1.5 million galaxies from the BOSS survey, we can actually look at the positions and measure them very accurately between galaxies, and galaxies themselves will cluster together, and they have a special length in the clustering, and that is the same ruler that we see in the CMB. So not only do we have a ruler for the very early universe, but then we can compare it in essentially in much later times in our galaxies today, and we can compare and see if they're the same length, and if they are, well, that will tell us a little bit about the dark energy.
So it's really just using the distribution, the clustering of galaxies as a ruler. And does that apply to quasars as well?
It does, yes. It gets a little bit harder with the quasars because they're fewer in number. But there's this very untried but very novel technique, is we'll actually use the quasars essentially as backlights, just as a distant backlight. And then the quasars' light actually will illuminate, or at least we see in the signature of the quasar, lots of evidence for the intervening hydrogen gas in the universe. And again, that we can begin to figure out where the hydrogen gas between galaxies is, and this is tracing the cosmic web between galaxies and groups of galaxies. And this is again a potentially another very powerful way into measuring that same standard ruler where the hydrogen gas is in between the galaxies. And this will also be another step towards seeing how ultimately the dark energy evolves.
Well, it sounds like you've got a very tough problem ahead of you. When exactly do you hope to get the first results from this survey?
The very first data will be taken later on this year in September, and all things being well, always with one of these technical projects. So the first year results could be actually not too long after, maybe 6 months, a year, for the very initial, we've switched the telescope on and it works kind of results. But the big results will not be probably available, not come out to maybe 2011, or probably around the time of the London Olympics in 2012 will probably be the first big news.
Well, Nick, we hope you keep us updated on the results, and it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show this month. Thanks very much.
It's been great being here. Thank you.
Thanks, Quinton and Nick. Now here's Alex telling us about what's in the sky this month.
Up in the skies this month, On the morning of July the 10th, Jupiter's four brightest moons, the Galilean satellites, all line up to Jupiter's bottom right, and so with a small telescope and a dark sky, you should be able to find Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. Also, for those who get up a little earlier, the same morning in the pre-dawn sky, Neptune will be very close to Jupiter in Capricorn, and depending on how dark the sky is when you observe, it may even be visible with binoculars. Observers in the Southern Hemisphere on July 22nd will see the longest total eclipse for the next 123 years, with the longest totality of 6 minutes 39 seconds occurring in a spot in the South Pacific Ocean. If there are any listeners who are likely to be in India or China on that day, I recommend you go out and have a look and see at least 5 minutes of totality from this best of the century event. Following on from the Eta Aquarids in May, this month sees the Delta Aquarids, visible on July 28th and seeming to radiate from the constellation Aquarius in the south. Like with their sister shower, although the predicted observed rate is about 20 meteors per hour, the moon is in its last quarter and so its light will overwhelm most of them, meaning the observed rate will be much lower. Meteor showers are caused when the Earth passes through the debris tail of a comet, and these meteors are all debris from one of the most famous, Halley's Comet. And that's it for the sky at night this month.
Thanks for the heads up there, Alex. And now it's the part of the show which we all live in fear of. It's the astronomy joke of the month.
Hi, Quinton.
Hi, Michelle.
Are you ready for an awesome joke of the month?
I'll be honest, I'm a little bit nervous.
You'll be fine. Drum roll, please. What do astronauts do in space to pass the time on long journeys?
I don't know, Michelle. What do astronauts do in space to pass the time on long journeys?
They play Astronauts and Crosses.
Oh. Oh, it hurts. It hurts. Ow. Well, that's about all we've got time for this show. I'm very sorry, listeners, and please, please listen again next month.